Welcome to From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archive's weekly series that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. Today we continue our 1968 series, recalling the past 40 years ago. And today, the story of the Mexican-American experience as recorded by Pacifica Radio. From the fields of the rich California farmlands to the gritty landscape of urban reality, there was a growing movement in 1968 within the Mexican-American community. Many Mexican-Americans have felt at one time or another a foreigner or an uninvited guest in the United States. As the civil rights movement led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. showed the world the strength of the African-American spirit and its capacity for organization and solidarity, the Mexican-American community began to recognize their self-worth and value in American society. There was a growing consciousness that they did not sail across an ocean and establish themselves in a foreign land. The truth is that they were always here for thousands of years. This renewed sense of value translated into demands for equality and justice in the workplace, in the schools, and in society. We see the establishment of the name Chicano to capture the renewed sense of pride and identity in the community. Thanks to leaders like Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta in the fields, and Rodolfo Gonzalez, Reyes Lopez Tijerina, and Bert Corona in the cities, we see a renewed sense of value in the Latino community spread across the entire Southwest United States. We begin with an early recording of Cesar Chavez in 1966, speaking on the challenges of organizing farmworker labor. At this point, he was co-founder with Dolores Huerta of the National Farmworkers of America, a precursor to the United Farmworkers Union.
On March 31st of 1962, I quit my job with the Community Service Organization in Los Angeles and came to Delano with the idea of organizing farmworkers, with the idea of forming a workers' group that would not rely on outside financial assistance at least for the initial part of the organization, a group that if it were to be organized would have to, at least the financial part of that organizing would have to come from the workers themselves. And so after a few weeks of rest and planning, we began the work of getting farm workers together, talking to them about the advantages of organization and also the responsibilities. In my 12 or so years working under Alinsky and Fred Ross, I had learned one thing, and that is that anywhere you go, you will find a small group of people, whether it be students or university professors or farm workers, who are already interested enough to do something about the problem that confronts them. So on this basis, I went, and in order to build the beginning or the foundations of the association, I visited something like 85 small communities, including labor camps, and was thus able to form the nucleus of the Farm Workers Association. When I look back on the beginning of that work, it seems like we've gone a long ways. And of course, when I look forward, it seems like we haven't moved hardly anything or anywhere. But the idea was that the workers themselves had to pay for the organizing, that there had to be a due structure, that if they really felt and believed that this was a way out of their conditions facing them, that then they had to put up the money. If they weren't convinced enough to the point that they wanted to pay $350 a month, that then there was no use in trying to organize them, and that perhaps my whole approach was not the right way of doing it.
That was Cesar Chavez speaking from 1966. Next, we hear from him again in 1968 in the middle of the first major campaign, the Delano Grape Strike.
In California, farming is so big, really, that the growers themselves have a new phrase for it, and they call it agribusiness, and it's really that. When we think of powerful corporations, I'm sure that the first thing that would come to your mind would be General Motors, Ford, AT&T, and others. And no doubt they're very powerful.
No doubt that they control a lot of commerce and money and so forth. But I'd like to tell you a little bit about the power that this growers have in the West, and in California in particular. The kind of power that land brings is a very awesome kind of power. It's an all-engulfing power. And all you have to do to understand this type of power is to look to Latin America, to look to Asia, and to look to other parts of the world, where land is a real issue, where a few control all the land and many have nothing. And there are three, in my opinion, there are three things that make them very powerful. See, if you own the land, you not only own everything that grows on that land, but you own everything that works on the land, everything that goes by that land. In fact, if you own the land, you own everything in that land and around that land. Once they had acquired most of the land, then they needed water. They had to have water to be able to make that land produce, to acquire the wealth and the power that they were seeking. And so what they did, they controlled the Congress of the United States and the many state legislatures, and they went around and they passed law after law, setting up reclamation projects, where even today, in a couple of more years, we'll have a water project in California running almost 700 miles from one end of the state to the other, providing cheap water to the growers. A lot cheaper they could pump from the ground, and a lot cheaper they could get if they were to pay for it at a reasonable, fair price. You know who's paying for that water? That water is being paid for by you and by us as soon as we get out of the strike. We don't pay taxes because we're not working. We've been on strike for 2.5 years. But you're paying for that water. After they had the land and the water, they needed people to help. There have been many arguments to sell the public on the idea that they need people from Mexico or from other countries. Some are very ridiculous. For instance, one legislator, one U.S. senator, in his argument for the growers that they needed people to come from Mexico, he was asked very bluntly by another senator who was not too in accord with the program. He asked him, "Why do you want people from Mexico?" And the reason is, and it's in the record, the reason he gave was, well, they're built close to the ground, and therefore they can do stoop labor. And then they talk about migratory workers, that the people here in this country don't want to do migratory work, or they don't want to do stoop labor. And let me tell you, and we have very good examples, no one can be as migrant as a seaman. Agribusiness in California last year was almost $5 billion. It accounts for one out of every three jobs in the state. So you see, we've got a job. The kind of job we have to do is very simple. Very difficult, but very simple. It's a fight of the poor against the rich.
El sol calienta ranchos anchos y de luz todos los baña. Ya esos campos van los niños campesinos, sin un destino, son peregrinos de verdad.
Here is Dolores Huerta from the year 1968.
They have tried to organize agricultural workers in this country, I guess, for the last 50 years, and attempts have always failed. I believe that our union is the first one that has had any success at all, and it's, of course, primarily based on, well, political. The political situation in California has changed somewhat over the last 30 years, particularly since labor unions became strong in the country, so that now we have a political backing because of the labor unions in California specifically. And I think a lot of credit has to go to Cesar Chavez, the director of the union, who has done such a tremendous job. He has set such an example by his own personal commitment. Cesar decided that the farm workers were not going to get organized until they started doing something for themselves, and so he set about to do it, and without any money. I just went around and talked to workers and first of all gave them faith in themselves that they could do something. And once he was able to do this, he could draw he drew them into an organization and began working to try to get recognition as a union, which we now have.
In May of 1968, a conference was held at the University of California, Los Angeles, called the United Mexican American Students Symposium, gathering the leading academics, poets, and activists in the emerging urban civil rights struggle in the Mexican American community. One of the symposium's producers, Montezuma Esparza, activist, educator, and film producer of such film classics as Zoot Suit, La Bamba, Selena, and Gettysburg, came to the KPFK studios to reflect on the 40th anniversary of this historic event in Chicano history.
May 1968. UMass UCLA had just been one of the key players in helping to organize the Chicano student walkouts of just 2 months prior, where 20,000 high school kids throughout the city of Los Angeles, and in particular Roosevelt, Belmont, Garfield, and Wilson, went out on strike for over 2 weeks protesting the tremendous dropout rate, the fact that almost no Chicanos or Chicanas got to go to college. And this is the first large group of Chicano students who have managed to get into college and have gotten into one of the most prestigious colleges in the country, UCLA at the time, and who have said, we are going to open up the opportunities for our brothers and sisters who are still in the barrio, who are being told that they are not worth anything, that they cannot go to college, that they can't be professionals, at a time in which less than 2% of Chicanos got to go to college and even fewer graduated. And the movement, the Chicano movement, was in a tremendous power push at this particular moment, coming out of what we were hearing was going on in Crystal City in Texas, where Chicanos took over the city council. What was going on in New Mexico was Reyes López Tijerina and the courthouse raid and the reaction of the military there and the government, who actually rounded up people and put them in a corral while they were tracking down Reyes. What was going on with the farm workers, the march that had already occurred to Delano, the strikes that were continuing, and what we were pushing, what we needed to do, which was to create an urban Chicano civil rights struggle. And we were organizing at that point every single day. There was a core group of us that were at that moment in time, in September of 67, UMAS jumped from 20 members to over 150 members because there was this first large group of students that had come in. And there was tremendous commitment. There was tremendous desire to make a change, to have an impact, to transform the possibilities for our community, to create our participation at the table in the society and in politics and culture and education, in all aspects. There was a tremendous flowering. Luis Valdez was at the forefront at that moment with the Triato Campesino. There were triatos that were being born everywhere. And there was a tremendous day-to-day activism that was pulling everyone together. And UCLA at that particular moment was a focal point. And so I was privileged to be a part of a group of Al Juarez, Carlos Vasquez, Juan Gomez Quiñones, Susan Racho, Evelyn Vasquez, Pat Tamayo, Terry McKenna, just a whole group of people who said, we are going to dedicate our lives to transform possibilities for our community. And we had a focal point through UMAS, and we had learned how to get the institution to support our goals. So, you know, I and several others, we wrote a proposal, we got a grant, we went out and created this symposium, we publicized it throughout the community, we bused in kids from East LA, from Roosevelt and Garfield and Lincoln, There were 2,000 people there if there was one. It was brimming. There were people everywhere celebrating that we were there and that we were creating a statement and that our voice was finally being heard on the main stages in the university and that we were creating this opening so that our community would have the power that we represented and that we would be able to exercise it and participate in the society. And from there, within a few days, the East LA 13 were indicted and I was in jail and the community was again organizing. And there were thousands of people that went out and protested outside of the police Parker Center and in front of City Hall. It was one of the most astounding periods. And it was beautiful.
Surcando el cielo de América, sangre de viento avanzando, forma de fuego en la noche, en ruina de allí.
Again, the 1968 United Mexican American Students Symposium recorded at the University of California, Los Angeles in May of 1968. Event co-producer Al Juarez makes these opening remarks.
For those of you that may have not been here in 1848 when our forefathers gave the official welcome to the Anglo-American community, we have since, we the members of the Mexican community throughout the Southwest, recognized that we are not included in what is known as American society, merely because we, as a people that were taken by annexation, we who were vanquished on the field of battle, so to speak, those of us who lost our lands because we refused to give up our heritage, our identity, our language, our religion, our customs, and our traditions, were persecuted in a merciless, barbarous way. Throughout the Southwest, the Mexican people were driven into a position of inferiority, shamed, ridiculed, killed, maimed, wounded. In time, they were hanged too, weren't they? In time, the Mexican community was dispersed, was lost. They founded it. They gave the very name of the Southwest that it has today, the city of Los Angeles, the cities States of Colorado, California, Texas, Nevada, Arizona. This is our land. And we pledge on our lives, on our honor, that it will continue to be our land, and we will be, continue to be the forces that bring about its productivity, that bring about its establishment, and that will continue to grow with the Southwest. We are here to stay. Thank you very much.
Ralph Guzman, professor of sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles, 1968.
To those in the ghetto, there is no question that the police are designed to keep them there. Thus, it is not merely a question of physical brutality by the police against members of the minority. We can assume that the incidence of physical brutality is small. We can assume that for the sake of argument. But far more important is the daily psychic brutality, the contempt and the scorn, the assumption of wrongdoing, the humiliation and shame before women and children. All these destroy a man in his own eyes and force him to question the basics, the basis of that law, the validity of that order, and the justice of that peace, so precious to others that they are willing to destroy his manhood. Without knowledge and human contact, there can be no provision for justice, and one cannot convince the residents of the ghettos that a policeman is his friend. The separation of justice and law enforcement is one of the great tragedies of modern life.
That was Ralph Guzman, professor of sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles, 1968. Next, we hear from Rodolfo Corky Gonzalez, former farm worker, championship boxer, activist, and poet, whose epic poem, I Am Joaquin, captured the imagination of the Chicano movement.
The first thing that we learn in our educational system, which affects us all, is that we're placed and burdened with these inferiority complexes, that we are the losers and we are the failures, that we are the bandits. They relate to us how any doesn't matter, as long as he's an Anglo, if he's a bandit today, he's a hero on TV screen. Joaquin Murrieta was the most vicious bandit of all time because, you know, he killed Anglos. Not only that, he was a handsome man, but you see him on Rifleman, he's again the ugliest looking cat you ever seen. But again, this wants to identify with a certain class of people. And we have to start identifying with success. And what's this all about? And what are the directions we should take? So I would want to say in closing to the young people that you are the new leaders. Don't place yourselves in the same confusion as some of our former leadership. Find the new direction of destroying and changing this society. And it's not only the betterment for your people, it's a betterment for mankind. Find out what the areas really are. Really realize who you are and believe in yourself. Believe in your people and give yourself some real dignity and also give them some real leadership. Remember that you can't teach your people sitting on boards and commissions. You have to go back to the barrios. They're the ones that have to learn. You can't teach the Anglo, but you can teach your own people. When we teach our own people how to evaluate, we can have movement, and then you can have real revolution, and our people have to decide whether they're willing, finally, even though it's easy to be exploited, it's easy to eat three meals a day, finally, are they willing to fight for their rights? Are they willing to fight for their name and their dignity? And are they willing to die for it? Thank you.
Montezuma Esparza.
Certainly Cesar Chavez was an extraordinary inspiration, and many of us, myself included, you know, in 1965, 1966, were picketing Safeway, were bringing food for the farm workers, and I was blessed and privileged to, you know, be a part of the last leg of the march to from Delano to Sacramento in 1965 or 6, I forget at this moment. And this was an extraordinary inspiration because we saw a man and a woman, Dolores, who was able to stand up and to bring people together with his words and inspire them. And equally important to us and specific to our situation in the cities was what was going on with Corky Gonzalez. Corky was far more influential to the Chicano movement, which has not really been acknowledged, because he represented the urban struggle. He represented a Chicano from the barrio. And the fact that he had been a fighter, a boxer, that he had been a champion, that he had struggled in urban politics, that he had been part of the Kennedy campaign structure, John F. Kennedy in 63, and that he had created the Crusade for Justice was enormously influential to Chicanos in the urban center. Because we did not want the world to see us strictly as farm workers, even though our brothers, our sisters, our parents, our cousins, my uncles had been braceros, had been farm workers. We were living in the city and we had a different reality. All of us grew up feeling like we were foreigners in our own land. My family had been on both sides of the border for hundreds of years. My dad had come to the United States in 1918. I had friends, who were Californios, who were native Indians from here who had an identity of being Chicanos. We knew that this land had been our ancestral homeland. We knew that this had been part of our legacy. And we also understood the historical forces that we were in front of, that there had been a war of aggression, of colonial aggression that represented the particular philosophy of President Polk at the time and of others going back to Hamilton, who saw that the United States needed to be an imperial power, that manifest destiny meant that they would have to go from coast to coast and that it didn't matter who the indigenous people there, who was there. Now, this was all understood at the same time that we had a fierce American identity at the same time. None of us were looking for Mexico to come and take over. I mean, that's a complete distortion of the psychology of the moment. I mean, when we created the identity of Chicano, that to us meant that we were Americans, and Chicano meant that we were part of the United States. What we were saying was, we were here always, we are here now, we were not immigrants, we were not foreigners, and this was our part of America, that we were contributing to this great, incredible country whose ideals were representing the ideals of humanity on the planet. The American dream was something that we were embracing as well. And the words that we used were aggressive. They were aggressive because we needed to capture our own identity, our own pride, our own history, and to restate it and to recreate it because it had been erased, it had been destroyed, it had been whitewashed, it had been obliterated, it had been taken out of the history that we had been part of the creation of the country, that we had made a major, major contribution to what America is and was to become. So the rhetoric, you know, in large measure, was completely misunderstood from those that were outside because they thought that we were creating a nationalistic stance for our own country. And no one really thought that. That was not where our heads were at. Our heads were in claiming our own pride in stake in having been part of this territory forever, because of our indigenous heritage, and that that was part of who the U.S. was, and to let the U.S. know that we were not foreigners, that we were not immigrants, and that we were part and parcel of the country. That was what was underneath. And the aggressive, militant words that all of us expressed, including myself, was what needed to happen at that moment in time for us to obliterate the negative self-image that we had grown up with, the subservient psychology that had been inculcated in us, the defeatist victim mentality that we had grown up with. All of that psychologically had to be dispelled. It had to be overturned. And this is what we needed to go through to create our own pride and identity that we could stand with as Chicanos.
That's it for this week's program. The recordings in today's broadcast were preserved as part of the 1968 Revolution Rewind Preservation Initiative. From the Vault was written and produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and yours truly, Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica Station listeners. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening.